The following Dharma talk was given by Lawrence Greco at Kanonji on Second Life. For more information about Lawrence Greco and Open Sky Zen, please visit www.openskyzen.com.
Well, it's good to be here. I've never done a talk like this before, so it's really interesting to be able to speak with people from, I assume, all over the country and perhaps all over the world. I'm here in New York City, and you know, those of us who live in areas where the change of season is very apparent, you know, really like this time of year. I think a lot of us do. I know it's my favorite time of year here in New York because we go from weather that was cold and damp a lot of the time and days that seem very short, you know, and in the thick of it, it gets dark by 4 or 4:30 here, like in October, November. So here in the city, we really crave this time of year because the days get longer, there's more sunlight. I happen to live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of, it's one of the greenest areas in the New York City area. There's lots of trees and parks and nature. And it always makes me think about the way nature works so flawlessly. If you look at how nature operates, it just seems to know what to do. So in the spring, the weather starts to change. It's like right on cue, it gets a bit warmer. You could even smell it in the air this time of year. You can tell that warmer weather is on the way. The earth rotates naturally. No one has to tell it what to do. Dogs bark. They don't meow. I've never met a cat that barks. But we're very different. So we're the only part of nature that seems to have some problems. We stumble around so much. And I think it's really this ability of ours and this tendency of ours to think that causes us to stumble around so much. You know, the French philosopher Descartes once said, "I think, therefore I am." So that presents us with a conundrum because, you know, are we simply to identify with our thoughts? Are we nothing but the sum of our thoughts? Am I nothing but the latest thing that went through my brain? But if you look at, you know, most of the time, and most of the world, I would say, does operate this way. So whatever pops into our heads at any given moment, we interpret as reality. So just by nature of having a thought means it must be true. So just by my thinking it means that's reality in that moment. And then what we do is we act based on the latest thought. And our behaviors and our emotions get dictated by whatever's popping into our brains. And needless to say, that leaves us feeling a lot less than happy most of the time. It's not really a sane and dignified way to live, but it's the way most of us tend to operate. But consider if you look at a pond during the day, all a pond does is reflect whatever's overhead. So during the day, it reflects the sun. If a bird flies by, it reflects the bird flying by. When the bird is gone, all you see is the sun in the sky again. At night, the pond reflects the moon and the stars overhead. Whatever else happens to be above it is what the pond reflects. But what we do, so we don't reflect what's happening. We reflect on what's happening. That's what's very different about us and the rest of nature. It's this tendency of us, of ourselves, to pile on our thoughts about things onto whatever it is we're experiencing. We're always weighing and balancing and deciding what do we like, what don't we like, what's okay about this moment, what's not okay about this moment. So we do a lot of second guessing, constantly second guessing. You know, I remember I used to work my first job as a teenager, right after high school, actually while I was in high school, was at a Roy Rogers fast food place. And my first responsibility was to take care of the fixins bar. So at the fixins bar, that's where you would get relish, ketchup, onions, pickles, all the things you want to put on your whatever, your hamburgers or your roast beef sandwich. All that stuff that's really kind of bad for you. And I always think of that when I consider the way we're always putting some kind of fixins on our day-to-day experience. So it's as if nothing we're experiencing is enough on its own. We always have to throw stuff on top of it. Like, we can't just have a hamburger or a veggie burger. We got to put some ketchup on it. Because nothing ever feels good enough on its own. Because we have this sense of, really, is that it? Isn't there something more? Can't this be sweeter? Can't this be better? Can't this be more entertaining? Or can I look better? Can't my spouse or boyfriend or girlfriend act better? So again, it's this tendency of ours to constantly second guess what's happening. And in so doing, we're missing out on what's really happening. And we're not really fully living our lives directly and honestly. There's this energy that some people call, like, you know, Sung San, Zen Master Sung San used to call it a don't know mind. We've probably all of us have heard the word emptiness or shunyata. Some people talk about God. So there's this energy that fuels everything so that it operates flawlessly. That's why when it's spring, the seasons just change when it's spring. There's no thought involved, it just happens. When a dog is hungry, it barks or wags its tail. So every aspect of nature knows precisely what to do. It knows what's appropriate, and it just happens, which is very different from us. So us operating from our thinking minds never really leads to a lot of happiness. Sometimes I think about, you know, did you ever see a sports figure who, after they win a game or a team wins a game, they're always thanking God? A musical artist wins an Emmy or a Grammy or whatever it's called, and they always thank God. But then it makes me wonder about, who do you blame when things don't go in a way that's pleasing to us? We're always weighing and balancing and judging our experience as good or bad or somewhere in between. So the very first thing the Buddha talked about, and really all he was mainly concerned with for those 40 some odd years he spent teaching, was this constant sense of dis-ease we experience, and how do we go about eliminating it, or at the very least, making it more manageable. So that's why he taught, the first noble truth he taught about was that life is dukkha. Sometimes I like to get a better sense of what something means or what a word means by discussing its opposite. So it's not really suffering. Like, you know, we always hear about, people say life is suffering. I think it's part of the reason why Buddhists have a somewhat gloomy reputation is that they think our message is that life is suffering, so just deal with it. Life is suffering, enjoy. But that's not really what we're talking about. So the antonym to dukkha is sukha. So I think that's Pali or Sanskrit or something. So sukha means sweetness, happiness, bliss, well-being. So dukkha, what we normally experience, is the opposite of that. Rather than start with a definition of what dukkha is, let's start with considering its opposite, what it doesn't feel like. And I think most of us could agree that a lot of the time, yeah, things don't always feel so sweet. We don't always feel so well. We don't feel at peace, at ease. We don't feel happy a lot of the time. So on one hand, this dukkha that we experience is like this bottomless pit of desire that always feels unfulfilled. So it's this constant state of dissatisfaction that causes us to either cling to something based on the pleasurable feelings it brings, pleasurable but temporary, or to push something away based on our aversion to it. So there's two things happening. There's greed and there's aversion. We want more of this, we want less of that. And that's all very subjective. So what one person might want more of is very different from what another person might want more of. So one person's source of greed might be another person's source of aversion. because there's nothing good or bad in and of any one particular thing. It's the value we assign to things in our minds that decides what we like and what we dislike. So we walk around with this like-dislike mind. And I would say most of the time, whether we're aware of it or not, we're constantly judging our experience, like the person we walk past on the street, like or dislike. The temperature, we like or dislike it. We wish it were cooler, we wish it were warmer. We futz around with a thermostat. We put on a sweater, we take off a sweater. At night, we adjust the pillow, we toss and turn. So it's this never-ending series of adjustments to try to reach this perfect state of okayness that never really seems to happen. So on the other hand, dukkha is nothing but a byproduct of impermanence and this emptiness I mentioned earlier, or sunyata. So nothing is ultimately going to prove all that satisfying because nothing is permanent. So knowing that all things are impermanent, we understand that things are constantly changing. Nothing ever stays the same from moment to moment. I mean, all of you are different people than you were about 15 minutes ago when you first sat down to hear this talk. So this isn't bad news. This is good news. Impermanence is not a bad thing. It sounds a bit disarming at first, but when you consider it, it's actually just simply the nature of things. It's the way a stream works. A stream, you can never step into the same stream twice, or the same river twice, I think the saying goes. So again, we're dissatisfied because we're either clinging to something we like or rejecting to something we don't like. And we do this in this futile attempt to bring about some permanent state of happiness. And that it just never seems to work. We're not going to ever get any permanent satisfaction through all these things around us, which are impermanent. That's reflecting we do. We're always reflecting on our experience. We're remembering. Now, there are actually these studies recently, I think it was last year, there was some study that suggests that the vast majority of what we perceive is actually a form of memory. So everything we encounter, we're bringing to what we encounter, all of these associations and concepts and ideas. And so we're not really clearly seeing the thing itself, whether it be the person in front of us, or the experience, or the sunrise, or whatever it is. We're bringing to it all kinds of other stuff, all those fixins I mentioned earlier, that obscure what's really there. Imagine how crazy would it be if you were looking at a pond and it was showing you an image of a bird that crapped on it 3 days ago. That's not overhead right now. It's kind of the way we work. Because we're so caught up in what happened before and what might happen later that we're completely missing out on what's happening right now. And really, what's happening right now isn't as bad as we think. In fact, it's quite good. And the more grounded we are in what's happening right now, the happier we stand to be. But so instead, we get wrapped up in trying to accumulate as many pleasurable feelings as we can, as many pleasurable experiences. And we think that's sort of the point. But even pleasure has an element of suffering built into it. Because once again, pleasurable feelings come and go. If you consider what it's like when you have, if you're eating some really incredibly good food, usually something sweet like chocolate or a great dessert, or if you're having amazing sex, you know, that feeling you have of, oh man, this is amazing. And, you know, part of it is this realization, even if you're not conscious of it, this realization that this can't possibly last for long, this incredible high I'm feeling. I know it's going to go away any second now, and then it's back to the regular dull state of affairs. Sometimes we get that look of pained ecstasy on our faces sometimes. And even like, you know, falling in love or, you know, when really gaga over someone, it has that quality of a bubble about to burst. Like it looks so perfect and beautiful, but we know if it's so delicate and fragile, it's just bound to burst. Not the relationship itself, but those fuzzy feelings that come along with when we first fall in love with someone. So again, creating a life that's all about just getting what we want is not a good idea. Very bad idea. So the problem with even when we do get what we want, we realize that it's, well, maybe not all it was cracked up to be. It's not exactly what we thought it was going to be, whether it be, you know, the person that we desired, the food we wanted, the job we wanted, the position in life we craved. So we spend sometimes years obsessing over something, thinking, well, when I have that, I'm going to be happy. When I get this kind of project, that kind of job, or I get this book published, when I get this girl or that guy, then everything's going to be just fine. And then we get that thing or that person, and then guess what? Kind of bored. Or it's not what we thought. Or we get what we want, and we lose it. That happens too. So we're always trying to alleviate our dissatisfaction with life based on these two mistaken assumptions. So for one thing, we think that there's something outside of ourselves that we could blame for our dissatisfaction. So either it's the person that did something to us, or the job loss, the relationship problem. And two, we feel like we lack something, like we don't have something. We've got to look outside of ourselves to fill that hole. We have to look outside of ourselves so that we can feel complete or fixed. And these two things are just simply not accurate, because we already have everything we need. We're already complete as is. And by not sitting with things as they are, we're missing something. We're missing the point. So all of this really comes back to this big I we create. This big I, this big me, this big my. We have this huge, huge sense of an I. We talk about I all the time. I want this, I want that, I'm like this, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a that, I'm this kind of guy, I'm that kind of guy. But then we don't really know, like, what am I really? Who are you really? What is this thing we call I? And that's the main question we ask in Zen practice. Is who am I? Or even, I even say to say who, I would say what am I? Because who sounds like, you know, we can get stuck on the particulars of our personality. And that's not quite it either. We're so, you know, it's easiest to see our small selves. You know, all these facts about ourselves we think we know that make us who we are and what we like to present to the world. But being fixated on that is not going to be very useful. By realizing that our discomfort with life really all starts and ends in our minds. And it's our ideas about things that cause us to be unhappy, to feel unsettled. So it doesn't mean that, like, you know, we should walk around like Dharma bots with no feelings or no responses to life, that anyone can do whatever they want and we should just smile and feel fine. Of course not. We live in this world and all kinds of things happen around us. But we don't have to be beholden to everything that happens around us. If we're going to base our sense of well-being and whatever happens to be going on at any given moment, whether they be world events or things with our friends or family or immediate environment, you know, we're going to be pulled around all over the place, up and down, like a yo-yo. So practice helps us develop this strong core. I don't know if any of you have seen that toy. They're called Weebles. And I remember as a kid growing up, the commercial used to go, I don't know, perhaps it still does, probably not. It would say, Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. So they were these toys that are egg-shaped little figures, little people, and they're weighted on the bottom. So when you try to topple one over, it might take it a minute or two, but they always wiggle around and find their way back to an upright position. That's our natural state. It's our natural state to be upright, to feel whole, to be content. But no matter what, and the more we practice, the more quickly we become upright again. By just taking time to be still, to be quiet, or to engage in whatever practice helps us stay grounded in the moment. Even when we're not being still, your whole life's your practice. Everything we're doing can be a meditation. The more we do that, the less we have to be concerned with judging and labeling, like, yeah, this experience was good, this one's bad, that one's mediocre. We can experience things as they are and stop blaming our dis-ease on circumstances and people, and rather understand that it's our interpretations of those circumstances and people that determine how we feel. Right? It's our constant desire that things be somewhat different than they are that cause us to feel uneasy. So ultimately, we don't know if something's good or bad. You know, Zen Master Song Song used to say, a good situation is a bad situation, and a bad situation is a good situation. So what appears to be really good might in fact be the worst thing to ever happen to us. And what appears to be bad might be the best thing in the long run. We don't always know. So we mustn't be fooled by the initial appearance of something. I have a friend once, I was walking around with a friend of mine on Broadway, and we have a mutual acquaintance who is very, very wealthy. And my friend turned to me and said, boy, you know, he has really good karma. He must have really good karma to have all that money. But I said, you know, I don't know about that. It's great to have a lot of money, but I also happen to know that this person had a lot of problems as a result of that money. People with all kinds of ulterior motivations for being his friend. And then the more you have of something, the more you have to worry about keeping it. And I happen to know this particular person with all that money ended up not being as happy as one might imagine he should be. So we shouldn't be fooled. This old story I heard once too about a very poor family who had only one son. So they were really banking on him being the sole provider financially. And for when the parents got older, they thought, well, this kid's going to take care of us. We won't have to worry. So one day he was riding a horse and he got thrown from the horse and he became crippled. So they thought, well, this is the worst thing that could ever possibly happen. Of course, their only son, poor guy, thrown from a horse, crippled, can't work anymore, can't walk anymore. Then just a few weeks later, the army came marching through the village and they took away all of the healthy, strong young men to go to war. So, of course, this young man was spared and he was able to stay behind and he ended up taking care of his family just fine. He took care of his parents, he provided for them, and as they got older, he was there for them. So we never really know what's going on. No matter how we try to control things and label things and judge things, we have no idea. So I look at it like having a sense of grace in this groundless situation of ours is the only way to go. And then we can reflect like a pond or a mirror, right? So if you hold something, I don't know, if I hold up a red ball in front of a mirror, the mirror reflects red. I hold up a white ball in front of a mirror, the mirror reflects white. Old example. But what we do, it's like if we stand in front of a mirror, we have this commentary in front of our heads. We start getting bogged down with these, you know, these conversations going on in our brains. And sometimes we pick apart the way we look or what we're wearing. But the mirror is not doing that. The mirror is not saying, boy, you could stand to lose a few pounds. Or I don't like you in blue. I like you in brown. That's what we do. So it's this adding we do, this adding, the throwing the fixings on. So think, consider that analogy of a pond reflecting or a mirror reflecting what's there. And see what it's like whenever you can to relate to your experience rather than relating from your ideas about your experience. In a way, it's like we're always creating this second life, no pun intended. Right? We have the life that's in front of us, and then we have this version of life we concoct in our heads. So see what it's like to experience life directly, as is, without the fixings. If you have any questions, I would love to hear them. Or comments. You're asking about, what do I think about mindfulness and the mindfulness movement? Yeah, I think, you know, mindfulness is becoming a very commonly used word. I'm not always sure what it means anymore, and I'm not sure that most people using the word know what it means anymore. Well, of course, to be mindful, I think, means to pay attention. It means to be aware, and the more we do that, the more grounded we become in the moment, and the clearer we can be. So essentially what we're trying to do is to be clear on, you know, my teacher Paul Lynch and I, he does koan practice with me once a week, and he's always reminded me that the point of this practice is to help us to understand the situation around us, so what's going on, our relationship to the situation going on around us. And then what's the best response? So it's situation, relationship, and function. What's going on? What's my relationship to what's going on? And how do I most appropriately respond to what's going on? So I guess if you look at mindfulness as a tool to help all of that come about, then I'm great. All for it. I see someone here saying, appreciate the thoughts today. I tend to want to rush around, make things different. Yeah, we all do that a lot. We're constantly rushing around, always on to the next thing. You know, it's almost like we look at the journey between here and there as the part we can kind of ignore. You know, I know here, like in New York City, we use cabs and subways and we walk around a lot. So a lot of us look at that like, well, that's not the real part of life. That's the part that we could kind of ignore, gloss over, or, you know, put the music louder on our earphones and till we get to like the real destination, and then that's real life. But then what happens is, we're, all we're doing is getting in this habit of missing out on things, even when we're at the thing we consider most important. So we get to the dinner, thinking, ah, now I've arrived. But lo and behold, we're already thinking about what happens after dinner. Or, boy, I don't like this person at my table. Or I don't like this food. And we miss out. Another person from William Hawksby, let's see. So Buddhist monks in Tibet are again emoting themselves over political issues there. Can that sort of response be justified in light? Oops, I've got to scroll back to that question. Excuse me, folks. Can that sort of response be justified in light of what you've been saying? Or is there a better way to respond? Yeah, that's pretty heavy. I mean, I see that happening. People are basically dying for this cause. They're killing themselves for this cause. Well, I cannot, you know, is there a better way to respond? That's a good question. I can't answer that. I can't tell someone else what they should or shouldn't be doing. You know, does it seem to be working? We can look at that. Is it bringing the issue to the attention of more people? I think so. So in the long run, is that a good thing? Perhaps. Will it change anything? I don't know. Adam says he's never found a destination. He just wants a new toy when you get there. That's what we do too, yes. And someone else said, this is a good reminder to just relax and see things as they are. Exactly. Relax and see things as they are. So I have regrets. So Valentine says, I have regrets. What is the Buddhist perspective on regrets? Well, I guess regrets are another form of thinking. I'm wishing that either something had turned out differently, or that I had acted differently or said something differently. Or I wish I had done more. I wish I had done less. I wish I hadn't said that. So those are regrets. They're basically thoughts about the past or thoughts about our current situation that we're not happy with. So I regret that I, you know, don't have a better job, or I regret having said that to someone. Again, they're just thoughts. And the second we're thinking about the past, we're thinking about something that doesn't even exist. So regrets are just another form of thinking. And engaging with our thinking minds all the time is not going to bring about happiness. It's not going to bring about sanity. It's not going to help us stay upright like the Weeble. Angus, so Zen asks, who am I or what am I? I think when there is something that think about itself, then it can't be an illusion. Maybe then people think that the ego is a wrong course of the universe, and to stop thinking is against this wrong course. You're welcome, Valentine. Boy, let me make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. I'm sorry, it's Argus Portal. Zen, who am I? What am I? When there is something. So Argus, you're saying maybe Zen people think that the ego is a wrong course of the universe. I wouldn't say that the ego is right or wrong or indifferent. I think this ego or the sense of self we have is the natural result of all of these different things that make us who we are. You know, our physical body, our impulses, our consciousness. So there's like this shadow left over. So like, say if I plant a seed and then I water it and then a tree grows, then there's going to be a shadow. So I guess this ego or the self we create is really the product of a whole bunch of factors that are always fleeting and dependent on other factors. That's why I feel like we don't really have a solid self to be so absorbed with. So this, the self we fixate on so much isn't exactly what we think it is. So who I am is very dependent on all of these factors around me that make me who I am. So I don't exist in and of myself. I don't exist apart from you. I'm not separate from you and from my environment. I don't know if that helps at all, Margus. William. So William asks, your background includes working with hospice patients. Would you discuss a little about how you approach issues of death and dying with them? Well, a lot of the time, you know, some people think the work is so glamorous to work in a hospice with people who are, you know, in some state of dying, which we kind of all are, if you consider it. But a lot of the time it was actually good practice for life, because it really taught me to just really be with someone, to not worry about what I think they need or should need, but to just see what do they need in that moment. Sometimes what they needed in that moment was for me not to be there. Sometimes what a person needed in any given moment was a cup of coffee. Sometimes someone, well, there was one patient that used to want me to read from her Bible. We'd read the Bible, talk about Jesus, talk about prayer. We would do some prayers. So whatever. It's really just about, you know, being very clear on what's happening, who am I with, what are they, really listening very deeply to someone. What are they saying to me? And not just listening to their words, but just being aware of everything. Looking at the way someone's looking at you, sensing something from them, being able to read between the lines sometimes. So it was really great work, and it taught me a lot about patience, and it taught me how to appreciate my life and what a privilege it is that I can just walk around without any kind of medical assistance, without any oxygen tubes in my nose or tubes going into my arms. And it really taught me how precious and impermanent this life of ours is. You offered support to the terminally ill. What opportunities does terminal illness present? The opportunity that a terminal illness presents is, again, that's very subjective. You know, some people can be very resentful when they realize they're terminally ill. Other people all of a sudden wake up to their lives and appreciate them more than they ever did before. Which, that's really, you know, not having a terminal illness, other than actually life itself is a terminal illness because our days are all numbered. That's a good question. I'm not sure I could answer that because I've not been diagnosed with anything terminal just yet. See if I skipped any questions. I'm going to scroll through a little. If you feel like I missed your question, feel free to retype it. Okay, Adam. We're hearing a story of Suzuki Roshi not wanting to go, so Zen practice can't predict how we'll respond to illness or death. That's very true. Excellent point. You know, again, we're not Dharma bots. So just because we practice, who the hell knows how we're going to respond to death if we find out we're ill or something happens to us physically or we're in an emergency situation. I was reading a book recently. I think it's called Every Moment is the Universe. And they were telling a story about a bunch of monks in some monastery, and an earthquake struck. And how surprised the author was at the very different reactions from some of the monks and Zen masters who had been practicing for some time. So, you know, this practice does not ensure that we never freak out or that we never panic. it doesn't turn us into some perfect version of ourselves or to some perfectly spiritual Zen person. You know, that doesn't really happen. That's a good point, Adam. What else? Well, it was a pleasure being here today. I hope you got something out of this talk, and you can always feel free to email me through my website or through Adam or however. And well, you're very welcome. But thank you all. Thank you for listening. You are the quietest crowd I've ever spoken in front of. Just kidding. Thanks so much. It was great to be here. And thank you, Adam, for doing this and for giving everyone this forum, this opportunity to learn and share the Dharma. You know, no matter where you are, it's pretty amazing, actually. So I hope you all keep that in mind and show your appreciation to Adam. So bows to you.